Welcome to the bookshelf. We continue with African Rice Heart, written and read by Emily Wilkins, and published by Pacific Press Publishing Association, copyright 2011.
I am a disco dancer. I stood in the marketplace with Daniel, a friend and chatty and teacher of French at the local high school across town. While we waited for Ansley to meet us, a crowd began to gather. They circled around us and, crossing their arms, whispered to their friends in dialect about my skin and clothes and hair and eyes. No one asked, "Where are you from?" or, like, "What's your name?" Nope, just good old silent arm cross staring. I don't mean only three people either. One person staring seems to give permission for 25 others to join in. I'm really used to it by now, but sometimes I just want to give them something to look at. I've contemplated dancing wildly, singing a really loud solo off tune, or just running at them, screaming like a crazy girl. I'm uninteresting, really, and I feel like their time is being wasted as they comment on my uneventful existence. But I just stood there anyway. Then Daniel said something that just struck a beautiful chord in me. Even though he's a local, because he was waiting there with me, he also found himself at the center of this ring. He looked quizzically at those who were staring and asked in French, "What are you looking at, kids? She's a person just like you." With giggles and smirks, the crowd realized the truth of what Daniel said and began to turn away in embarrassment. Right before I came to Chad, my 20-year-old brother Fletcher and his sweet girlfriend Laura and my dad and I went to the Autumn Fair where I live. Fletcher and Laura's aura of love and the way my dad hyped up the tractors and horse barns and lumberjack show, it made for an evening full of fun dynamics and memorable conversation. Fletcher, Laura, and I craved a funnel cake. But when we got to the booth, the line was long, especially in comparison to the line for the elephant ears. We decided that funnel cake was worth the wait anyway. Eventually, a wall of greasy hot air hit us, and we knew we were getting close to the front of the line. We'd been standing there with other would-be feasters for at least 20 minutes, and so I was starting to feel a bond with them. I decided that I would comment on our common situation, so I leaned forward to the girl ahead of me and said, "Wow, I almost caved in and just got an elephant ear, but I'm sure glad I didn't." Anyway, the girl totally didn't hear me, or maybe she just completely ignored me, but either way, I was left there hanging on my last word, waiting for a response that wasn't coming. Fletcher and Laura laughed hysterically at my very unsuccessful attempt to connect to that girl. Failed connection. However, standing on common ground is awesome. Sometimes here in Africa, it's like, wow, we're from really, really different worlds. What would we have in common? But then we'll connect over some odd and funny thing, such as when little Armel, who's 3, felt my prickly, unshaven legs and then compared them to her own. Or when Moondin sang, "I am a disco dancer," at the top of his lungs, or when we played soccer out in the blazing sun behind the church in our bare feet. Trying to connect to people. Even if your attempts fail, the few times when sparks fly in you for a few seconds actually feel like you're reading the same page of the same book and laughing at the same exact parts as those around you, it's so worth it. Dinga's heart. Dinga is my African sister. Her fragile body whispers grace as she moves around tending our home in Bere. She weighs a mere 80 pounds. Though small, Dinga has a big presence, and though uneducated, she's extremely smart. And though she doesn't speak French, of all the family members, she is the one I hear loudest and clearest. Dinga's family lives across town. I don't fully understand why she lives with us, but we were both adopted by this family, and maybe that's why I like sleeping next to her on the big mat. She never asks for more blanket during the night and always takes up less than half the pillow, and she rarely kicks or hits me in her sleep. She isn't in school, but she's husband shopping weekly, lining them up on benches outside the mud wall and bringing them tea and sesame balls and peanut butter soup. What qualities she's looking for, I'm not really sure. She and the boys, they rarely exchange more than jokes, and I've gathered that these are maybe only the preliminaries, the tryouts, if you will. Perhaps there have been follow-up visits that I haven't seen. Dinga sings in this out-of-tune yet oddly melodic string of notes, and she holds babies constantly. In the evenings, she'll tell me that my hair is a mess, and then she'll braid it in these ways that really never look good on me anyway. My temples always burn after all her yanking of hair in those sensitive places. I try not to whine, but there I am, always crying but not sad. Dinga used to wash the dishes until she realized I knew how to do that. Now she says, Emily Pulkatas, Emily, wash the dishes. So now that's my job, scrubbing crusty rice out of the blackened pots. I want to be fat, Dinga tells me. Then pointing to her frail body, she says, this, not good. She is such a gem. Yes, she's as valuable as the most precious gem you can think of. But Dinga has a bigger problem than her weight. Though she's just 14, her heart beats out of her chest. Some days, it beats in good rhythm, consistent, reliable, strong. Other days, Dinga literally looks brokenhearted. At those times, you can ask her these questions and she won't even hear you, or at best she'll nod without even caring what the question was. Her heart, defective from birth, beats arrhythmically, skipping beats, pounding against her ribs, and visibly moving through them. Every time it happens when I'm there, I hate it that it's so often, I'm helpless, wishing I could steady it. Her lips shake and quiver, she shivers, and her eyes just flash despair. Often she'll grab my hand and place it on her chest where I can feel what's happening. Bam, 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 bam. I know feeling someone's heart beat through their skin is nothing compared to having that heart in your own body and having to feel every beat it makes. One time I woke up in the middle of the night and Dinga was gasping. Her shoulders were just rising and falling in painful rhythm with her breathing, attempting to keep pace with her heart, which can be completely unpredictable. I panicked and asked, ça va, ça va? She replied, ça va di, combining French with the negative of this region's dialect. She was saying, it goes not. It goes not for her. Seriously not going. Not well anyway. I asked if she wanted water, wanted to lie down, or wanted my blanket. Solution, where are you? The heart is so deep in the body. If it were a matter of a cut on her foot, no problem. If it were a superficial burn, we'd just do something about it. But how do we get to her heart? It's a bigger problem than Africa's equipped to deal with. Rusty Pink. The hospital has a payment plan that allows people to leave some object of value, their bike, a metal pot, or a cell phone, as collateral until they return to pay their bill. They have 2 months to pay off their debt. Some people decide to simply leave whatever they've left as collateral rather than coming back and paying to reclaim it. When the 2 months have passed, the hospital assumes the property and sells it to pay the medical bill for which it stood as collateral. The hospital had a yard sale yesterday, and I joined everyone who was buying the collateral that people had abandoned. I bought this rusty pink antique bike. When I brought it home, my African family laughed at it. They told me it was such a bad bike. Sabine, who's 18 and has signed up to be my critic while I'm here, laughed and said, I'm really sorry for you, Emily. Désolé, Emily. But Jago, 18 and optimistic, told me that he would help me get it fixed up. We went to the market later in the day, and Jago told me to pretend that the bike was his so that I wouldn't get ripped off. So I just played some tag-along white girl while he bought all the parts. We had a really good act going. We got the bike all fixed up for a fair price of about $20, and I rode it home. New tires, new pedals, new seat. My bike has two really great features. First off, the bell. It rings in this dull, halting, bullet sort of sound, but it rings nonetheless. Second, it has this rather fragile-looking rack that hovers over the back tire. A second person can sit on the rack and ride along with their legs straddled on either side of the back wheel. I plan on taking it to the river all the time. Every day. And I can take a friend along, too. It's perfect. There's one downside to the bike. It has no brakes. It's not even like they're just broken, they just don't exist. Of course, Chad is undeniably flat, so maybe I'm safe. And perhaps the lack of brakes is the reason for the bell. Instead of stopping, I simply ring the bell and everyone gets out of my way. These small, joyful things like bikes and bells just really shine up a place that's sometimes so dark. Pass it on. So Stefan found me yesterday and said a slight bit frantically, Emily, I made a mistake and sold you that bike. The person who owns it's here to pay it off and pick it up. You have to give it back. I'm really, really sorry. Stefan had thought the hospital had already had the bike for 2 months, so I bought it for 8,000 francs, which is about $16. Not a bad deal. I took the bike and got everything fixed for an additional 10,000 francs, which is $20. After it was fixed up, even my family, who said it was a bad bike, loved my pink bike. So when Stefan told me that I had to give it back, I just had to laugh. I mean, I guess it had been a nice bike rental. I took the bike to the family who owned it as they waited outside the hospital office. I watched their faces just brighten up as they realized that their old junk bike had received a complete makeover. They didn't know what to say. They had beaming smiles of gratitude, and we took a picture together with the bike, and as they were leaving, they thanked me effusively. I wish I knew how to say pass it on in French, pass on the favor. Meanwhile, I'm missing my bike, and the walk to the river is super long. Blood in my mouth. Rubber suction bulbs were stitched into both lower quadrants of his abdomen. They filled almost every hour with post-surgery bleeding and drainage, and it was critical that they be emptied regularly, lest the fluids accumulate and distend his belly. Ideally, I'd be heroic. Approach the wincing patient confidently, empty the suction bulb, calmly re-engage the suction, make note of the millimeters discharged, and then knowledgeably assure the family that the patient, yes, is on track to recovery. But more than often, that's far, far from the case. I find myself less courageous, stepping back from bloody messes and wanting companionship when addressing intense suffering. I'm so scared of being alone at death and at moments of great sadness. Today, when I unplug the suction bulb of the man's lower left quadrant, intending to empty it, blood sprayed in my mouth. I instinctively spat on the cement while my mind just flooded with all the thoughts of HIV and other blood-borne pathogens. Here, as I'm still in the beginning of my experience, I have so much fear, both legitimate and illegitimate fear. Sisters-in-law. Last night, I worked the night shift. About 11 p.m., a man came in with his foot bleeding a bit like a river flows. He hadn't brought any record of medical history, no money, and as he told me what happened, his breath was hot with alcohol. To make his long story short, he had gotten into a fight with his sister-in-law. She had taken a rice blade to his foot in anger, and his brother brought him into the hospital 4 hours later. I couldn't help but laugh a little bit. I mean, what a sister-in-law he's got. Then I remembered that I'm going to have a sister-in-law very soon. Taylor, my older brother, is getting married a few weeks after I get back to the States, and I'll get a sister. Yes! Then I think again, and I start trembling at the thought. I've just seen evidence of how crazy a sister-in-law can be. Yikes. Girls have always liked Taylor. He has this kind, reassuring presence, but he also projects a feeling of quiet mystery. Over the years, he's stolen a lot of my friends, who then morphed into his girlfriends. But Nilmani, he found her all on his own, and the lottery has totally been won, people. Nil is so awesome. So after this guy tromps all over our emergency room, dripping blood everywhere and almost falling over, I got him to sit down outside. Samdi and I then soaked his foot in a blue basin of bleach water and then scrubbed it well. Samdi put stitches in and I bandaged it up. He went home that night and we laughed when he was gone. Sisters-in-law, yikes! Their thing. I was talking to my parents on the phone this morning, and I told them that I'd overcome my fear of riding horses alone here in Chad, and more specifically, of riding them to the river by myself. My dad said, "Emily, you really shouldn't go to the water alone. Take someone with you when you go." I pretend to resent being looked after. I spout off things about my age and how big of a number it is, how independent and safe I am, and how I'm never in any danger. But in my secret thoughts, at least some parts of me greatly appreciate my father's care. This morning, I saddled Libby and I was riding the west road out of the village when Samity saw me. "Emily, where are you going?" "I'm going to the river." "Who are you going with?" "Myself." "Emily, that's not safe. It's better if you go with someone else." "That's what my real father said too, but don't worry, I know how to swim." With a shake of his head and the use of my favorite French phrase, "toi là," meaning "you there," he wished me on and well. Libby trotted choppily past lots of dogs. They spooked her badly, putting her on edge for the rest of the ride. When I ride past dogs, I just make sure we're going really, really fast. The sooner we get by them, the better. Because if they nip Libby's heel, I'm done for. When we reached the river, Libby was sweaty and tired. I tied her to the bush using this really creative knot. It's one where I weave the rope around the branches and leaves, and then I just believe in it. I just believe it's gonna hold. I was alone at the river, so it was quiet and I could talk to Libby and not feel stupid. Walking to the edge of the river, I stripped to my swimming suit and waded up to my waist. That chilly point, and then I dived in. It was so cold and so appreciated. I dunked my head, keeping my lips tightly sealed. The cleanliness of the water is iffy. Paddled against the current for a while and then swam across the river to a dusty, beachish place, almost sandy, where I stretched out. My mind went from thinking about the water quality of the river to my faucet at home, to the flies that were landing on my eyelashes, to hippos, and at that point I started hearing things. Glancing up, I saw people approaching. Have you ever met people who are just doing their thing and whatever their thing was, it was just inspiring because of how they were doing it? It's not like their thing was some big, amazing thing. It's just something about the way they do their thing. These ladies approaching me were doing their thing, each one of them carrying a load of long, skinny branches, firewood. I couldn't have gotten my arms around one of those bundles if I tried. They weren't bundles of kindling. No, sirree, they were sticks like 7 feet tall, and each woman looked like a stick herself. So it was like four sticks dressed in big, baggy shorts carrying sticks. As they got to the river, I realized that they were going to cross. They hiked their baggy shorts up around their stickish legs and strode slowly through the water, leaning into the current, all the while balancing those bundles on their heads. I called out to them, "Mulugwia budja," which means, "You work a lot." They called back, "Oh, oh," which means, "Yes, yes." "Munpulkaga," they asked me, "You're bathing." "Onpulkaba, jog jog oma dikuna," I replied. "I bathed already. Now I'm going to sleep." "Mungabapulka danga," I asked. "Will you come and bathe too?" At that, they leaned their bundles teepee style around a tree at the river's edge and came and joined me. So here we are in this dirty river, bathing together. They stalled with the water at waist level, and I told them they should get all the way in, that it felt good. But they replied, "Kala budja," which means freezing cold. After a while of this funny small talk, I said I was going back over to my beach to sleep. When I got there, I did a snow angel in the sand, and they thought that was so funny. Obviously, being in Africa, they've never seen children play in snow. "Wanda surshaiga," an invitation to tea tomorrow. They told me where to meet them and told me to come anytime in the afternoon. That I would love. Then they raised their firewood to their head again and chatted as they started out briskly on their long hour walk to the market. Just doing their thing. I love that way they were doing their thing. Calling death. Today, when a woman died, Samadhi told me to take her pulse. I felt her right wrist and said, there isn't one. But then the responsibility of pronouncing death being too much for me to bear alone, I asked Samadhi to take her pulse too. Pronouncing death almost feels like killing. Who wants to be the one to say that there's no hope for life here? To give up? To decide it's over? No one signs up for that, and yet when someone dies, pretending that he or she didn't won't last for long. Sometimes I think I'm maybe not finding the right place in the person's wrists or the place where the pulse might be felt, but no, the person's just really dead. We announce births and welcome the newborn, and then at the end, we say goodbye and say the benediction. I'm learning about death's arrival, and it's hard. So hard. A good whipping. A confident little child followed me after I called his name into the emergency room. He climbed up, dropped his pants so they hung around his ankles, and then sat bare-butted on the salmon-colored examination table. He had obviously done this numerous times, and there on his thigh was a bandage that he had come to have changed. I peeled the grippy tape back carefully and then remembered how much more it hurts when you pull band-aids off slowly. The tape they use here sticks so well to dry skin. In fact, as I peeled it off, the top layer of brown epidermis came off too. When the dressing was off, I saw a clean slice about 3 inches long on his upper thigh. It was almost healed and mostly scarred over. The dressing change required only washing the healed wound with bleach water and then scrubbing some of the dirt from around the edges. It really looked quite good. I asked him if it hurt as I washed, and he said, "No, it's okay." And I believed him because he didn't flinch or wince. As I put another piece of tape over the wound, I asked him how it had happened. I thought it was a weird place for an injury like this. He said, "My teacher hit me." Ugh, sick feeling. This kid had come to the hospital because a teacher hit him with a stick. The stick had cleanly laid open his leg. I didn't know this kid or his potential for bad behavior or what he had done that might have provoked the teacher to hit him like that, but it didn't matter. I only had ill thoughts of that teacher and my blood pressure went up. I finished my shift and went home. I usually sigh out my anxiety when I enter our cluster of huts because all the pain of the hospital is countered by a wash of good things at this home of mine. Visitors drinking tea, babies gnawing on green mangoes, and then Jolie and her joyful songs, children tugging at my fingers and the strong feeling of belonging, the sweet air of community. But today was different. The air was silently angry and no one was moving much, just tensely standing around. I pretended not to notice and I gathered up my things for my shower. As I walked towards the little mud enclosure, I heard some commotion. I turn around and I saw Isidore, 13, and Tony, 11, arguing with each other. Then, out of nowhere, Jesue, the oldest of Sammy's children, who's still living at home, came onto the scene with speed and fury. I have never seen him like that. Usually he's so kind, so compassionate and loving. I froze behind the bathroom wall, peering over it. Jesue started whipping the boys and yelling things I didn't understand. His first stroke broke the stick he was swinging on Isidore's shoulder. I whimpered instinctively and clutched at my shower basket, eyes locked on my brother's. The next few hits made all my muscles tense up. Tony escaped, running through the field, but Isidore got caught by the neck of his shirt and dragged under the central tree in the courtyard. With his free hand, Jesue reached up and broke off a branch from one of the neem trees, and Isidore got the whipping of his life. I couldn't watch. I felt like I couldn't stop this. People whom I respected a lot were simply letting the situation play out. People like Jolie and Esther and Salmon. I backed into my hut and sat on the edge of my cot in my shower robe, just listening to the symphony of cries and hits and pleas. Since then, I've sat like that on the edge of my cot quite a few times after shocking situations in Bere. It's becoming really familiar. When the screaming stopped, it was replaced by crying, full-out sobbing. I came quietly out of my hut and walked over to where Jolie sat. I asked her why Isidore was treated like this. She told me that Isidore had insulted his uncle Jesue and that he's little and needs to respect his elders. She said that it was good that he got this beating. Ça là, ce n'est pas bon pour mon cœur. She nodded sympathetically, letting me know that she'd understood. Isidore hid behind the tree literally for the next 2 hours, and no one talked. I wanted to go over and just hug him. But to be respectful to the culture, I needed to let him cry. Or did I? Just because something is cultural doesn't mean it's right. I'm learning that this is true. But I'm also learning that because something's cultural, you have to understand the culture before you pass judgment on it or try to change it. And I'm still gaining understanding. But deep down, no. Actually, not that deep down. Pretty superficially, fairly clearly, I felt that being whipped so hard with so much uncontrolled anger was wrong. And as I talked with Samity this morning over breakfast, I said, "Samity, I have so many questions, but I don't have enough French to understand the answers yet." He laughed and said, "You'll get there, Emily." I know I will, but I'm just so impatient.
You've been listening to African Rice Heart, a young woman's journal of radical service. It was written and read by Emily Wilkins and published by Pacific Press Publishing Association, copyright 2011. Join us again next time on The Bookshelf. I'm Ellie Hockett. Caitlin Webster and I, from the Lewis and Clark PICI class, are the editors for these bookshelf programs, and Vern Windham is the producer.